Yeah, none of my family members have ever eaten each other.
No. Mine have come close, but no. If you're listening, Mum, I'm sorry.
Rusty Quill presents Enthusiasm. Hello, friends and fans, and welcome to Enthusiasm, the show where we talk about a few of our favourite things. I am your host, Helen Gould, one of the best Rusty Quillers, and today we're talking about mythology. And I am awestruck to be joined by Becky, John, Liz, and Munna. So, we are, as always, going to introduce ourselves alphabetically. So, beginning with Becky today, what are your pronouns and what do you do?
Hi, Helen. Thanks ever so much for having me on. I'm Becky Anderson. My pronouns are she, her, and I am one half of Black Armada Games, a games design outfit. And I've designed award-winning games, much to my shock, such as Lovecraft-esque and When the Dark is Gone.
They're very good games.
Thank you.
Next up, John. What do you do and what are your pronouns?
Hello, Helen. I'm John. My pronouns are he, him. I am one half of Askew Productions. We work on horror and weird fiction audio dramas, some of which, both of which are Rusty Quill Network shows. Our most recent one is The Silt Verses, and there should be a season 2 of it just around the corner.
Ooh. I mean, by the time this comes out, it probably will have started. But yes, very cool. Next up, Liz. What do you do and what are your pronouns?
Hi. Yeah, so I'm Liz. My pronouns are she, her. I was an editor on the Magnus Archives and now I'm on Special Projects. And I kind of got given Special Projects when Alex just handed me this mop and said that I needed to to just do this sort of deep clean business and like really get this understanding of part of the business that he thought that I just hadn't had a chance to get into yet. So it's going well. The smell of lemon is much stronger in my life than it used to be. But I'm hoping for big things in the future.
I'm sure you'll achieve them.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
And Munna, what are your pronouns and what do you do?
Hello, I'm Munna. I'm she, her, and I'm the other half of Askew Productions, as John said. We work on horror and surrealist kind of fiction, audio drama. John didn't mention that he is actually the writer behind both I'm in Askew and The Silt Verses, and I do the production behind it, and together we also work on the Patreon and all sorts of extra bits. So essentially what that means, I'm the person who sort of kicks in the room next door where John writes and goes, no, you have to do all of this all over again. And in the middle of that, we try and stay married.
Aw. Well, that all seems to be going very well so far, and I'm extremely happy for you. So we're gonna talk about why mythology is interesting first off. I would, people can jump in at any point, but for me, like, the bizarre and occasionally disgusting things that happen in various myths is a big appeal, because I'm like, wow, how did you come up with this? Would anyone like to tell me why you feel that mythology is interesting? Oh, am I going to have to pick on someone like a teacher?
I've got a relevant bit, but I'm way too polite, so this has been the first time I'm going to jump in like this. I completely agree with what you said, Helen. I got into mythology when I was very young. My parents bought me a book of illustrated Greek myths. And it's one of those books that you get your hands on, you open it, and you realise that your parents made a terrible mistake because it was in no way appropriate for children. The first page was Kronos eating his children, and you go, oh, wow. Yeah. This is a whole new world. And with lots of children's fiction, even when it gets very dark, I'd read a lot of Roald Dahl at that stage. It's still that fairy tale darkness where there's an instructional element to it. There's some sense of justice. The villains normally get their comeuppance. The protagonists normally use pluck or courage to win the day. And what really struck me about this book was how unjust, cruel, and arbitrary the stories often were.
Mm.
Like you say, it was almost the first horror fiction I ever consumed, where it was trying to make sense of a universe where horrible things can happen to you when you may not deserve them. And that's just the way it is. There's no moral, there's no lesson to learn from it. Sometimes you might just be turned into a spider because the god thinks you're too good at weaving.
Yeah. But that's an interesting thing, because there are also lots, for Greek mythology particularly, there are lots of different versions of those, because some of them have Arachne being turned into a spider because she specifically boasted that she was better at weaving than Athena. And some of them have Athena just being jealous. And so I find that very interesting to look at as well.
Mm. Yeah. So coming from New Zealand specifically, growing up in New Zealand, you've got different mythology that you get exposed to as well when you're growing up. So, you know, the Māori stories of the creation of New Zealand, and also the heroic kind of tales that are related to that. So we have Maui as well, who people are probably now more familiar with thanks to Moana coming out. But the creation, I think that idea of having an understanding why a place that you're in is the way that it is, and having that being quite specific to your area as well. It's interesting to me that these things, even where cultures have mixed, you know, say more in Europe and Asia, they would have still kept very much their own story about how things were and how things are. And it's got that sort of, that social cultural reason behind it, as well as the religious background that almost all mythology is linked into. So I really like that sense of that it grounded you in the place that was New Zealand. It was part of like how your identity is shaped, is part of understanding that story. And then of course, because I have essentially British heritage, I used to also read into the Celtic myths. I quite liked reading into those because it gives you that other sense of like, well, what's this other landscape which is linked, you know, very specifically to me? So how did it think about itself, and what were its heroes? So I used to really enjoy reading the Celtic mythology, and as well as the Māori mythology as well.
That's really interesting. I really don't know much about Celtic mythology. I have a vague impression of giants at some point.
Yeah. There's Finn McCool, which was, I named one of my cats after Finn McCool, but it's such a great name, like Finn McCool. I mean, come on.
Oh, Finn, that's an Irish figure.
I think he goes across to the Scotland as well. Like, I think is he not linked to the Causeway? Like, the Giant's Causeway is linked to that character.
Mm.
But you've got that crossover of the regions where, you know, even though it's Ireland, you've got those stories being mixed because they would have been talking to one another across the water, so to speak.
That's so cool. And Giant's Causeway is so cool. I'd like to visit it sometime.
I'm probably completely wrong, because I'm always completely wrong at least once in this show.
Okay. Let us know before we release it, and we'll just edit that out.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons why I have enjoyed mythology in the past is because I feel actually a mix of both what both John and Liz have just said, because I moved to Europe when I was younger. I'm from Somalia, and which is in East Africa, for those who don't know. And I initially started getting into mythology because I actually really enjoyed Xena and Hercules when I was younger. I don't know if anybody watched those TV shows.
Oh, yes.
And I would come home from school and I'd watch them, and my mother wouldn't understand why I was watching these shows. And so from there, I then wanted to study archaeology at university. And I wasn't necessarily interested in the excavating part, you know, just sort of being in deserts and brushing at sand for hours. It was more about, you know, how did these myths come to be part of entire communities and cultures? And then when I started researching universities, I realized they actually don't let you study that until PhD level. And then I was like, I can't do this, so I just picked English literature instead. But for me, one of the things that I've really enjoyed getting to know more of in the last few years is actually African and Somali mythology, of which there are so many different stories, because so far all you really read about when you have British heritage and you grow up here are Roman, really, quite honestly, Roman and Greek mythologies, actually more than Celts, really. I don't really remember Celtic or Gaelic mythology studying that at school, unless you count certain bits of literature like Gawain and the Green Knight or Beowulf.
Or King Arthur, maybe.
Yes, and King Arthur. Yeah, absolutely. But that's about it. You don't really study it in the way that you would study, you know, the Iliad or any of the other stories that you end up studying a fair amount. And so it's been really exciting learning so much more about all these different cultures. And I guess I'll dive into it quite a bit more. But one of the things that I enjoy a lot about African culture and African mythology is more the fact that it isn't a single narrative. So there isn't really one narrative, one story that follows a person. It's more about how mythology is part of the land, the earth, the water. It's very nature-centric.
Yeah. That's interesting, though, because like Africa is the continent that's got the most countries on it.
Yeah.
But all of, like, lots of those countries are sort of artificially imposed on the continent. And so, I don't know how to articulate this. I think it's something about how various countries will share similar myths because people were, like, those lines did not exist until people came along and drew them on with a ruler.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and actually a lot of African cultures, and I caught myself almost there because I hate saying African cultures because obviously, you know, a lot of different countries here being swept into one word. But a lot of the countries are nomadic. And so people were traveling back and forth between various tribes and lands and so on. And so you're right. It is, you know, that the different countries as we know them in the modern time, the reason why these countries share lots of similar myths is because there were no borders when these myths were, I guess, being pulled into society, or when they were happening. Who knows?
Becky, what are your thoughts?
I was just pulling my thoughts together as I was listening to everyone else's excellent contributions. And I was thinking that one of the things that I loved about mythology when I first, as a child, it sort of came into my life was how different it was to the organised religions that I had experience of, which obviously as a white British woman is not exhaustive, but in the sense that the god that they talked about in church was so very different from Zeus and the Roman gods and the Norse gods and the Celtic gods. And the idea that the Greek gods were off having these petty squabbles and rivalries and getting annoyed with each other in a really human way, but with god powers. I think I found that absolutely relatable and compelling and much more kind of eye-opening of culture and relationship with deity than the more formal religion that is the primary religion in the UK. As I said, I can only really talk about church as opposed to other religions, but that the way that that the major organized religion of Christianity talks about deity, it's not the way that Zeus was bed hopping with every animal, vegetable and mineral that he could get his hands on, and you don't have the jealous wife of Hera wreaking her revenge on relatively innocent humans and things like that. And it was a much more kind of visceral way of thinking about religion, but also much more relatable,
very human way.
Exactly.
Yes, one of the interesting things about Greek mythology, I think, is that it doesn't try to impose a strict morality on things. It's not trying to say, the gods are good. It's
they portray the gods doing like terrible things for a different reason, often to be like, you shouldn't mock the gods because they will happily you up.
and I think specifically, you know, those Greek and Roman ones are very like very human, because you know, if you go to something like maybe Hinduism, where the gods have their own society and they have their own things going on, but they're just not jerks like most of the time. like as you say, Zeus is just a massive jerk. Like he is 100%, you know, like too much power, white dude privilege.
I think that line between religion and mythology becomes so deliciously blurred, doesn't it, at some point. But at some point it feels like it's not blurred at all, and there's a very clear delineation.
Yeah. Well, I've always, you know, I had one of those silly revelations one day when it occurred to me that I was seeing these things written down as like myths and legends from New Zealand and myths and legends of this. And then I'm like, these are creation stories, and these are like, you know, I grew up a little bit religious. So I grew up like with, you know, Old Testament understanding of how the world was created. Not that I particularly believed it, and I don't think the rest of my family did. But you suddenly realize that word is never imposed on essentially the state religions. Like, we never talk about the mythology of Christianity, but there is one, right? Like, every religion, the mythology is really just saying these are the stories which particularly are probably not linked. Like I'll give like things like Christianity and Islam a little bit of difference, where you've got like, say, Jesus and Muhammad, who were essentially real people, where you've got, okay, their stories, maybe you wouldn't use the word mythology around them because they're linked more to historical events, whereas like you might say, you know, like the Old Testament, Genesis, that would be like, well, yeah, that's a mythology, right? It's a creation story, and that's like 100% what every culture will have in some way, something which explains why they're here and what they're doing here. And actually, even you know, I grew up also reading a book which was fairy tales from around the world, and I was busy thinking about that, thinking, well, some of those fairy tales are probably myths, because the ones that I'd read, which were, you know, African, were ones of like the spider, is it Anansi and a few other characters. And I loved those. I wasn't so keen on the European ones, because the European ones were literally the fairy tales of like, you know, someone wants to be a prince or a princess, does three tasks, job done, right? Like they're very samey. They, you know, it was a book where there was a lot of those very samey stories, and then you got to other parts of the world and all of a sudden all the stories were very exciting because they were following quite different things. And I think that was because they were actually more myths rather than fairy tales. So
what's the difference? When I was preparing for this podcast and doing all my homework and my research, so I could sound as clever as possible, I was thinking, where do we draw the line between fairy tales, folklore, mythology?
It draws back to a lot of what we've been saying, I think, because other than the fact that mythology is in theory meant to go back to our origins and to be looking at the questions of how we came to be, there is a huge amount of snobbery around it. And that comes back to things like kids in the UK being taught that Greek and Roman mythology, that's mythology with a capital M. But if we're talking about the story of how the devil tried to throw some rocks at a town and he missed, and that's why there's a huge hill there, that's folklore. That's seen as something quite trivial and parochial and not worthy of study. I was looking through a book I've got of Pan-African creation myths, and the introduction by some very worthy academic was talking very loftily about how, unlike mere folklore, which is just entertainment, mythology is these great questions of who we are and what our cultures mean. And the very first creation myth was the story of a mythological hero pinching baboons' bums to make them red, and that's the story of how the baboons' bums came to be. And you go, it's ludicrous to be claiming that mythology stands apart. Like, you know,
whimsy is a massive part of mythology.
Huge. I was going to say, I know that I wanted to talk about my favourite myth, and my favourite myth is the one where Odin transforms himself as a raven to go off and steal the mead of poetic inspiration, and he brings it back, but as he leaves with it all in his mouth, he's transformed into a crow or a raven, I forget, please don't strike me down, but as he flies back with most of it in his mouth, like he accidentally farts out three drops, and the people that landed on, they're the bad poets, sadly. Sad for them. I always thought that's such an irreverent. You really needed a mythological explanation for why some people are just really, really bad at
that. That is brilliant. Yeah. I love it. I love that so much.
But I do think there's a little bit of that, and I forget what the saying is, you know, whoever, what is it, the hunter glorifies the tale of the hand or whatever. It's basically whoever writes the story decides which the important parts are, right? So it's whoever has first started kind of recording them, or, you know, how the myths were recorded and passed down is how we decided which were myths and which were folklores. I mean, one of my favorite mythologies, or I guess like, it's actually just like kind of like a folktale, really, but it's seen as mythology, part of Somali mythology. It's like there's a cannibalistic goddess named Degder, which loosely translated means long ears, and she hunts in the forest for lost children. And there is kind of like a Hansel and Gretel type story of these two twins who try and escape her. And actually, if to this day, I remember my mother telling me this story when I was young as a, I don't know why she told me that, actually thinking back on it, it's quite terrifying. But, you know, when I was older and looking into it, I actually realized, well, Somali people are nomadic. And so were these stories told to children to stop them going off and exploring a new local area as we, you know, as we being tribes moved from sort of area to area? Or, you know, did someone a bit tired or a bit drunk see a hyena and then come up with a bit of a story around the long-eared, you know, cannibalistic creature that is hunting you? I don't know, but this has been passed down to become a myth that now, you know, thousands of years later, hundreds of years later, we're still kind of learning. But I do understand how that, perhaps in Western culture, wouldn't have been seen as a myth. That would have been seen as more of a folklore, because it hasn't been, it doesn't have that kind of the gods and the kings and the queens aspect of it. And maybe that's, yeah, maybe that's one part of it as well, that if there isn't a god or a king or a queen within the story itself, then maybe it isn't recognized almost as noble enough to be a myth.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think my definition is, I feel like fairy tales are specifically aimed at children. Folklore is kind of like mythology that doesn't have a through line.
Mm.
Whereas like a lot of mythology, you have the same characters cropping. But then there are several. No, scrap that.
There are some pretty evil fairy tales that maybe are not necessarily that child friendly.
I don't think they're.
Yeah, but you still tell them to children anyway.
I was going to say, I think that they are intended for children, even the very gory ones. So, like
even
original,
the nasty ones.
The original Brothers Grimm are absolutely intended, I believe, to be morality tales for children.
Mm, yeah. Apparently, when they were, from what I understand, I'm sure it was Grimm's Tales, but when they were composing that together or bringing all those stories together, they had. After I think the first revision or the first time it was released, they had to change a lot of the stories to not be about the mums, but to be about stepmums, because they got a lot of feedback that the mums were not so keen on like all these stories which talked about how evil the mums were. So,
oh no.
So yeah,
that's really funny.
So originally a lot of those stepmums were actually just straight up your mum.
That's very funny.
And so that's why there are so many like non-existent parents in Disney.
Exactly. They don't want to be blamed.
That's right. Yeah, I'm not sure that there is really. Maybe the difference between mythology, folklore, and fairy tales is just your amount of snobbery when looking at them. I think, John, maybe you were on the money with that.
I'm sure there's some very erudite academic description, which tells us very clearly which is which.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm sure that John's actually right.
This is probably anthropology 101.
Yeah. Yeah.
But none of us have studied anthropology. Yeah. So we're just doing our best. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back after what I presume will be some ads. Hello, everyone. Helen here, who you may know from Rusty Quill Gaming and Enthusiasm. Today, I'm here to tell you about We're Alive Descendants, the sequel series to the award-winning audio drama We're Alive. From KC Wayland and Wayland Productions, We're Alive is a survival horror odyssey spanning 6 seasons and 13 years. Set 18 years after the original series We're Alive, A Story of Survival, follow the harrowing journey of the next generation of survivors in Descendants as they discover how much of the world has changed, how the infected have evolved, and face the conflict sparked by humanity's efforts to reclaim a lost civilization. Join this new generation as they work to make sense of this deadly new world before it consumes them and everything they know and love. We're Alive, Descendants will bring together narrative threads from the first 6 seasons, but is also a great place to start for those new to We're Alive, and should appeal to fans of zombie fiction in general. Created and produced by Wayland Productions and executive produced by us here at Rusty Quill, We're Alive Descendants premieres April 5th. Search for We're Alive wherever you listen to your podcasts, or visit www.wearealive.com or www.rustyquill.com for more information. And welcome back. So, due to my own failings, we started talking about things before we came back onto the recording. Becky, you had some interesting things. Well, everyone had some really interesting things to say just then about modern myth-making and how it affects current politics in terms of, say, for the example I would give is the 2012 Olympics in Stratford and how the opening ceremony is seen by many as like a high point of British culture. And all of us who had indeed been around were like, no, 2012 was still quite crap, actually. And there's a nostalgia for something that happened only 10 years ago, and people seem to want to get back to what they think that was representing. And now there's like a myth around how 2012 was so much better. But actually, I mean, it was a bit better in some ways, like not having a pandemic, but we still had lots of problems and people are trying to forget that. Becky, please restate some of your thoughts on that for the audience who were not there.
I will, and I'll contextualise them a bit. So I think a lot of mythology comes from human beings trying to make sense of things that they are frightened of, things that are uncertain, which is why often early myths are so rooted in place. The deep, dark forest, Poseidon and the sea, you know, things which are out of your control, which could manifestly affect your destiny. And I think that we see that again and again and again with political movements and things like that. And what I wanted to kind of draw out was that myths are felt very deeply in human beings. I think all human beings feel myths really deeply. It's almost like the ultimate fan service, you know, like every time somebody mentions a myth, you're like, it stirs something inside you. And I think that is really powerful and it's really important. And there are people out there today who use that for their own gains. And I'm going to give a very ancient example so that I don't offend anybody. But I know that one of the ancient kings, I think it was one of the Edwards. I can't remember which one. It was definitely not a recent Edward. And
we've had so many Edwards.
We've had a lot of Edwards. It was quite a long ago Edward. And he worked very hard to associate himself with the more ancient myth of King Arthur for his time, because King Arthur was seen as this great heroic king, a golden age for Britain. And if he could associate himself with Arthur, then that would make him more popular amongst the people. And he was very much restating the Arthurian myth, making out that he was Arthur's natural successor in very many ways, and doing so very, very deliberately to manipulate the population to make him more popular. And I think that we see this time and time again, and not just with the ancient myths, but as you say, We are starting to, particularly in times when we as human beings are feeling uncertain or feeling under threat, yeah. mythology has a very powerful pull on us at that point. And we have modern mythologies coming out about those times. And I would say kind of another example to lead on from your 2012 example is the current, I would say, quite mythologizing of NHS, the NHS
yeah.
heroes.
Yeah. Mm. Mm. I want to also mention, because you've just talking about Edward and King Arthur, that also that goes even further back to various Roman politicians who would try to claim lineage from Venus. Mm. And I think Caesar also did so, but also made himself a god.
Yeah.
In addition.
And didn't they often,
like in his own right.
Didn't they often reference Romulus and Remus as well? Would they try to link back
yes,
into them?
I suspect yeah. so.
Yeah. Which is a great, it's like one of those great, like, how a city was started. Well, two kids raised by wolves. You know.
And then one of them killed the other one.
And like, what a great statue you've got. Hooray. Of, like, you know, the she-wolf and the baby suckling. And you're like, it's quite interesting.
Yeah. There's huge amounts of examples of this, though. Like, I think in America there is a lot of trying to associate yourselves with the founding fathers, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah,
and deriving a legitimacy from that. I think in Britain there's a lot of trying to associate yourself with Churchill.
Yeah,
and deriving legitimacy from that.
Maybe you'd write a book about him or something. You know, that would be a way of, like, you know,
just spending your time.
Yeah, one might.
Yeah,
one yeah. might.
Figures who I probably should we should probably clarify were hugely complex. In the same way that Zeus was.
Yeah, I think you're right. And in the same way that you said the mythologizing of the NHS, and I think you mentioned, we were talking about this, I think, in the break, it's the mythologizing of the Blitz. I think it was Liz who said that, you know, it was during the war and, you know, we were all in it together. And at the same time, people are mythologizing themselves and their families, because often people will say, you know, don't you know my grandfather fought in the war, or, you know, my grandfather fought
yeah,
for your rights.
Yeah, yeah. Or... it's about personal lineage.
Exactly. So I don't think it is just people. Of course, there are individuals who may try to claim a lineage to Churchill or, you know, liken themselves to it. But I think actually a large number of people do it on a smaller basis.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
It's like we've got like there's a hierarchy of mythology, like there's a cultural, social one, and then there's, and it goes down to more personal levels where you have your own narrative, your own story of, like, your own creation myth for your family, for yourself. And then, you know, you build up. And most of the time it's doesn't involve exciting spiders, sadly. But we should build that in, though.
I think that's a really useful reminder for us, and almost answers a question that we were saying back in the first half. Is it really surprising that there are these commonalities when myths are not handed down on tablets of marble? They are shaped by audience response. You know, is it any wonder that people love the same stories of tricksters who always get away with it? It's the same reason no one likes it when Tom gets Jerry.
It's fun.
It's something that time and time again is shown to be more popular, and then the myth will change in response to that. One Somali myth that I really find fascinating is the story of Arawelo, who was a real life historical queen who seized power through some kind of violence. It was a very big deal.
Lots of violence,
but
tons.
Oh, so much violence. But if you read the mythology around her, you know, in any other circumstance, she ought to be a culture hero. But lots of the folktales about her are very much revisionist takes, probably written by men trying to make it clear that it must never happen again that a queen seizes power. So they tell the story of how she castrated every man in the kingdom. Somehow children still keep popping up in the story after that, but...
did they do a Daenerys Targaryen on
a
her?
A little bit,
I think, yeah.
But then in these stories, she becomes the antagonist, almost an ogre figure that the heroes are hiding from in the woods, and they need to figure out a way to outwit her or overthrow her at every turn. Mm. When in another circumstance, she should really be the protagonist.
Yeah. I actually think that's brings me on to a point where actually myths. The good guys and the bad guys of myths also change depending on how society is changing and moving. Because in my mother's and my grandmother's era, and this was, you know, love their cotton socks, but, you know, an era where women were generally a little bit more oppressed and, you know, a different time, a different society, they probably would have also, and they did kind of tell the story of Arawelo a little bit more, as in she was the antagonist. But people our age, you know, my age, millennials and so on, are actually taking ownership of Arawelo, and it's become something in lots of, you know, my peers and other people that, you know, that you kind of know online and stuff, who are calling themselves Arawelo 0.2 or as, and so on, because it's claiming back something that you may have been told was negative, but actually you see the positivity in it and the empowerment in it.
Yeah. That reminds me of that statue of Medusa, if you know it, where Medusa is carrying Perseus's head. I do, because I follow a lot of sort of Greek and Roman classicists on various social media, and you're absolutely right. There is a reclaiming of particularly feminine mythological villains in a sort of girl boss way. I do want to move us on a little. We've already touched on this, but I want to talk about what our favourite stories like actually are. We've got a lot of theory and concept down, but let's talk about the weird stuff that happens. So, John, you've mentioned Procrustes, the worst bed and breakfast. Does anyone else have a story that immediately springs to mind?
I have one in terms of like the Greek and Roman, well, I guess it's Greek, is...
Oh, it can be from any mythology, obviously.
Yeah, but I just, I mean, I love anything with an animal, but I love the Pegasus one because it's, I think, Bellerophon captures him, takes him to kill some dragon-y thing, or maybe it's a chimera, I can't remember exactly what it is. But then he's done that, and then, of course, the guy thinks he's like super big man boss pants, and is like, I'm going to ride you to heaven. And as they're on their way up, it's like the Pegasus just kicks him off. And then he goes on. And I'm like, ah, oh, so beautiful. Just like gets booted off by the Pegasus. And then it's like that Pegasus just goes to live off in heaven by itself without this dude who's just being annoying at this point. So I enjoy that a lot.
Yeah. One of my favorite bits in the Odyssey is when... so one of the many times that Odysseus gets shipwrecked, I think one of the first times, they're on this island and there are all these sacred cows there that are owned by the sun god. I think it's Hyperion. And they don't have any food with them. And Odysseus is like, right, we can't eat these cows because they're like holy cows and it'll go badly for us. He gets distracted, he comes back and they've killed some cows and they're eating them, and he's like, oh no, what have you done? And then the dead cows start to like move around and moo from like the pots and stuff. And that's such a bizarre ghost story. And then I think like they all get hit by a plague. And that's like Hyperion both cursed the cows and hit them with the plague as punishment. There's so much weird stuff that happens in the Odyssey, though.
It's always the weird stuff is the best bit.
It is.
I think the brevity of myths really helps with that, because you get something completely bizarre in a single sentence and then you're just left with it. You go, the first man... his daughter grew out of his thigh and was born out of the open wound. Oh, moving on now.
Yeah. This guy's daughter he had a headache, so he tapped himself on the head and his daughter like jumped out in armour. That's Zeus and Athena. Becky, you were saying that you quite like Norse myths, and from watching Vikings, which I know is extremely accurate.
100%.
There's a lot of interesting stuff in there about Ragnar Lothbrok and Björn Ironside and Lagertha and various interesting figures from that portion of history. I don't know if you know anything about that, or because there's some weird stuff that happens there too.
So I don't know that. I am a lover of Norse mythology, but mostly from reading the Eddas and things like that.
I see.
And I have to do my usual disclaimer that I think the Norse Norse mythology has been co-opted by some very bad actors in exactly the same way I was talking about earlier, people trying to associate themselves with myths, and they have brought an interpretation to it which is not served by the original texts in many cases. And I think that there's one of my favourite bits of Norse mythology is actually Ragnarok, is the idea that they know the end of the world is coming. They're expecting there's going to be a massive bun fight over it, and that a lot of what Odin does is about trying to find out more about this thing and stop it. And it's just this idea that the gods aren't all powerful. There is something that they're frightened of, and that they're on a mission because they know a doom is coming. And I always kind of found that quite compelling. Again, kind of feeding back into the our mythologies, just ways that we contextualize our fears, and to see mythological characters experiencing, even godlike characters and god characters experiencing that same level of fear, I find really relatable, as I said earlier, and compelling.
My favorite myth is actually Somali, and it's an insane family, right? So let me see if I can get this right. There's Negder, who I've just told you about earlier, which is kind of like this boogeyman, a cannibalistic mother with long ears. And her victims were usually children. Now, Buti is a shape-shifting human creature who's one of the children of Negder. And she actually fell in love with the human race, not a particular person, but she just thought humans were very kind and very loving. And so she risked her life to warn a village that Negder was stalking them. And as she was warning them, Negder became so angry that she cursed her child to be a shapeshifter with a ravenous cannibalistic hunger. Now, Buti had given birth to twins and five other children. And Buti ate five of her children, and only the twins survived. And so they ran away. And after they found out that she'd, you know, eaten their father and their five siblings, and they ran away. And Farah, so it's Faduma and Farah. Farah actually got married. And his sister, he lost his sister as they were running away. And while he was waiting for her, he got married. But he waited over 10 years. And at this point, he realized that he couldn't live without his sister. I mean, forget his wife and his children at this point, but he really couldn't live without his sister. And so he prayed to the gods that he would be turned into a tree. And he was turned into a tree. And he never found his sister again.
Oh no,
isn't that insane?
That's so sad.
It's so sad.
That's so incredibly sad.
Yeah, I mean, you really, if you think you've got a wild family, I mean, you don't want to be part of this family.
Yeah, none of my family members have ever eaten each other.
No, mine have come close, but no. I'm if you're listening, Mom, I'm sorry.
Yeah, ours was a family where, you know, if someone had lost a finger at the dinner table, it was, you know, fair, would have been fair game for not getting it out the way in time.
I was going to ask if anyone remembers, because that's reminded me of a similar story where this old couple were very hospitable to Hermes and Zeus, and Zeus was like, you can ask like one wish and of us, because you know you've been so nice. And they said, well, you know, we've lived together, we're in love, and we have been for you know many decades, so we'd like to, you know, be together forever. And so they died at the same time and both got turned into trees with their branches entwined.
Aww.
And I think that's the nicest Greek Greek mythology that I know.
Yeah. Oh, John looks really unhappy. Why, dear? Don't you want to be turned into trees?
Getting turned into trees happens so often in mythology, and it always feels like a little bit of a trick, right? Because the tree is going to get chopped down at some point by the onslaught of civilization.
No! There is no
John. Why?
There is no industrial, you know, complex in this world. There's only nature and
birds pooing on you. It's all there. Overrated. Becoming a tree.
You're a tree. You don't mind.
What you really want to become is a fungus, like a really, you know, like one of those ones that lives underground and just talks to the trees and just spreads the nutrients around. You're not sentient.
Yeah. Yeah.
Knows the name of God.
But you know, you're pretty...
But you're basically immortal.
Yeah, you're immortal.
Yeah, I was about
you're
to say,
useful.
It's really hard to kill you.
Yeah, yeah. You basically own an entire forest as long as the forest is still standing.
We are at the end of the episode. This has been a much more introspective episode than I thought we would get. I thought we'd mostly be talking about, you know, how Hercules has a fat ass, but
I'm sorry that we didn't actually talk about the
bum sizes.
Yeah, figure with the best ass. So, you know, if anyone wants to chuck one in there.
I'm just going to put it out there again, Pegasus.
I don't know. I think I'm going to have to go with what John said earlier before the show started. Xena, she has.
Yeah, I mean,
great I didn't ass. Say that.
No? Okay, well, I'm saying it. Xena, great ass.
All right.
Thank you all for being on the show. This has been just like, it's just such a lovely way to spend my time listening to smart people talk about interesting things. Listener, I hope you have enjoyed it as well. I will see you on the next episode. But for now, it's goodbye from me. Goodbye. And it's goodbye from all of them. Would you all like to say goodbye?
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Enthusiasm is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 international license. It is directed by Helen Gould, produced by Lowry Ann Davis, with executive producers Alexander J. Newell and April Sumner, and edited by Marissa Ewing, Tessa Broom, and Catherine Rinella. Thanks for listening.